Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me talk about Philadelphia beating Boston 103-92 to stave off elimination and extend that series. And to me, that's a good thing. It's a very good thing because it means we get at least one more game of these two teams going at each other. And I'm not talking about going at each other in a basketball sense, although that has been good. I'm talking about going at each other. Now, I suppose I should do the responsible thing and actually talk about the game itself. You know, like smash your vegetables before you have your dessert. So I'll go ahead and do that. Let's get that out of the way. Let's get that game stuff out of the way. Brett Brown puts T.J. McConnell in the starting lineup, and the Sixers have a totally different look and feel, a completely different energy to them. McConnell was taking on everybody and beating them all off the dribble. He scored a career-high 19. He came through with 7 rebounds and 5 assists, and he got the crowd into it every single time he touched the ball. Not only that, but Philly played tough. Joel Embiid was banging in the paint, dropping bodies on the floor, and between McConnell's energy and Embiid's attitude, Philadelphia had enough to keep this series going. And to me personally, I could not be more hyped because extending the series means getting another game of these dudes getting chippy with it. You know, like that second quarter scuffle between Terry Rozier and Joel Embiid.
And now Rozier called for a foul on the pitch off. And Rozier and Embiid come together. Rozier threw a shot into Embiid's chest. Tempers flaring.
Thanks to TNT. I'll take another game of that. How about you? I'll take another game of that. I'll take another game of Joel dunking, then celebrating, and then having Boston's Marcus Morris drop a 3-0 hand gesture on him. You know, like, as in scoreboard. Look up at it, big fella.
Philadelphia, Joel Embiid has given a lot of yapping. There's been some extraordinary trash talk in this one. It's not for everybody, but Joel Embiid saying we're in your head. Marcus Morris saying 3-0.
Yeah, if that's not for everybody, it should be for everybody, because that's awesome. Morris went 3-0 not once, not twice, but 7 times over and over again. It was great. I mean, it was great. But it's 3-1 right now, which means we do get another game of this. Another game of Joel showing up the post-game presser wearing a shirt that reads, "History will be retweeted." Another game of Joel Embiid describing that scuffle with Terry Rozier.
He kept the ball away from me and tried to punch me twice, but too bad he's so short that he couldn't get to my face. And I didn't understand why it was a double technical, because I was just trying to get the ball and he was the one trying to swing. But next play, those type of plays, he just kind of like boosts your energy and takes your game to another level. So I like getting into that type of stuff.
Freaking Joel. He tried to punch me twice. Too bad he's so short that he couldn't get to my face. See, that right there is why I'm not ready for this series to be over. Because I don't want to face an entire offseason without Joel Embiid pressers. Just like I'm not ready for Marcus Morris to stop getting spicy after the game.
I'm just looking forward to the garden and the atmosphere in game 5.
I'm ready to go now. You know, they had a lot to say in here. They did what they supposed to do. They got one. Did what we supposed to do, and we got one. So, you know, we go back, like I said, 3-1, and hopefully we put it away.
Quote, bleep, I'm ready to go now. Bleep, I'm ready to go now, too. I mean, this series may turn out to be that classic gentleman sweep, but there is nothing gentlemanly about this series. Both teams are under each other's skin. They don't like each other, so I love it. In most situations like this, the team with a 3-1 lead is feeling pretty good, pretty mellow going into game 5, but not here. I mean, does Marcus Smart sound mellow to you?
What do you expect the environment to be like when you guys get back home?
We're pit bulls. It's a dogfight, and we're going straight for the neck.
How confident are you, and what do you think the Garden crowd will be like?
I'm very confident. Man, what's understood don't need to be said. I think everybody in the world knows what the Garden crowd is going to be like.
We're pit bulls, and we're going straight for the neck. So the series could end tomorrow night in Boston. But this doesn't feel like the end. It feels like the beginning. This feels like the start of a rivalry that could run for years. We're only 4 games into their playoff rivalry, and they're already throwing punches, making short jokes and dropping 3-0 series lead gestures. They're really good basketball teams, but they're even better trolls. Look, I never ask anybody for anything. I never ask anybody for a favor. But is it too much to ask for a favor right here? Is it too much to ask that we get at least a game 6? I'm not even going to dream or get greedy and ask for a game 7, which would be awesome. Too beautiful, right? Right now to even imagine. But a game 6, is it too much to ask? Let's have it. I need it. The world needs it. We all need it. Let's get it to a game 6 because that game was awesome. Chris Haynes joins me. Chris, good morning. What's up? How are you?
Jim, I'm doing fine, man. Thanks for having me. Likewise.
Always good to have you, Chris. Thank you. Why don't we start with the Warriors and Pelicans. Take me back to Game 3. It's a good place to start. That's where the Pelicans smashed Golden State by 19, Chris. What happened to Golden State in that game?
You know what? That was a game where, you know, going into that game, players were talking amongst themselves and talking about not being complacent, making sure they handle business. They really wanted to sweep this series. You know, that was the main focus. And, you know, they were talking about days leading up to that game 3 bout about how we got to stay the course. Let's not let distractions get in the way. And at that point, you know, remember the Charles Barkley escapade with Draymond Green? That was going on. And then Kevin Durant, he had got into it with DeMarcus Cousins during the regular season. So the team was kind of expecting there to be some antics probably by some fans leading up to that game. And so they were really, like, we thought they were going to be focused, but that was the talk. That was the main point of emphasis going into that game, and they just laid one and gave New Orleans life. But it was really a bizarre scene for a team who put so much emphasis on going into that game and trying to get it over with as quick as possible. To see them, you know, fall flat like that was definitely a disappointing scene.
ESPN's Chris Haynes joining us. Well, Draymond Green did not take that well. We know he was really bothered by that performance. He had a hard time getting to sleep. Having spent some time around Draymond, what do you think he was like the night after that game? I mean, is he pacing around? Is he watching film? Or is he just ready to snap?
Yeah, I mean, he wanted to leave the arena pretty quickly after that game. You know, he told me, look, he said he couldn't sleep that night. He just stayed up watching film and, you know, he got so irritated, you know, by looking at Kevin Durant, you know, he just felt like there wasn't any life within him in that game. And at 4 a.m, he sent him he described it to me as a long-ass text message to Kevin Durant, basically being critical of him, saying, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, but also encouraging him, saying, hey, I know you can do more. We need you to do more. You were brought here to do more. And Kevin Durant, hours later, once he received the text message about 9 a.m, he responded simply by, I got you. And then we know the rest is history. He goes for 38 points, and they get a big blowout win to go up 3-1. But, no, to your point about Draymond, Jim, that guy right there is the heart and soul of that team, man. He's the glue. He's the motivator. You know, he's the coach. He's the player coach, per se. He's really an integral part of that team. And a lot of things that he does, you know, on the court or even behind the scenes, you know, a lot of people he doesn't get the recognition for it. But he's definitely the glue piece that pretty much keeps that thing all together.
We're talking to Chris Haynes. I was actually going to ask you who is the spiritual leader, but that would answer that. Now, Durant admitted that he was not as aggressive as he needed to be in Game 3, but that all changed in Game 4 when he had the 38 points, 9 rebounds, 5 assists. Chris, when he's locked in like that, how impossible is this team to defend?
No, I mean, that's the Kevin Durant of the NBA Finals. When he's like that, when he's being aggressive – from start to finish, you know, you can make a claim that, you know, it's arguably him and LeBron James is the best in the league. It's just sometimes in some games he gets lackadaisical. Like, the game comes too easy. I mean, he is 7 foot. And when he wants to shoot, he can shoot. Nobody's going to stop him from doing that. And so I would think probably the game gets a little bored to him sometimes. And I'll bring that up to Kevin Durant sometimes. I'm like, man, like, you just going through the motions. And he'll snap at me. What you mean going through the motions? I'm in the NBA. You know, I don't go through the motions. And, you know, he doesn't – when I tell him things like that, like, sometimes he takes it as a slight. I'm like, law, I'm not saying that by any stretch. I'm just reiterating what it looks like to us. We know how easy the game can be to you. You know, at some times, and, you know, I can see why I may get bored. Yeah, but he admitted to me in Game 3, he was like, yeah, I wasn't aggressive. He said that wasn't me. And so he said it was good for Draymond to call me out like that, and I want to make sure I keep this flow going. Now, the problem, Jim, the problem is when KD's aggressive like that, like when they're looking for him to be the focal point of the offense, that's when sometimes other players start to struggle or they start to think things out, think things through. This offense is created to have, like, heavy ball movement. Like, everybody, if it's open shot, anybody and everybody can shoot. But when you're zeroing in on Kevin Durant, which they have to do sometimes, that's when other guys tend to struggle. And so I think that's the balance Kevin Durant has had to face, you know, since joining the Warriors. He wants to find that balance of being aggressive, but he doesn't want to take everybody else out the game. And I think that's one thing that we'll probably still continue to see as the postseason moves on.
Now with new Post-it Extreme Notes, you can get that message across and you can get that job done in any weather condition, including rain, heat, and humidity. I'm talking in any element whatsoever. I've got these things all over my office and every single Post-it Extreme Note is right where I put it originally. New Post-it Extreme Notes are water resistant. They're made with DuraHold paper and adhesive, so they'll stick to pretty much anything at all. Concrete, drywall, raw wood, even brick. So no matter what the task is on that job site, you can get that message across with new Post-it Extreme Notes. Again, communication is everything. You can't lead if you can't communicate. You've got to get your message across. Do it with new Post-it Extreme Notes. Buy them today, wherever you get your Post-it notes. I know with these Post-it Extreme Notes, I'm never going to have to look around on the floor or under my desk ever again. They'll always be right where I put them. New Post-it Extreme Notes. ESPN's Chris Haynes, my guest. All right, Chris, so what do you see in Steph Curry? He's had 28, 19, and 23 points in his three games back from injury. How has he looked to you so far?
He's still trying to find his footing. You know, he says his win is good. He said that's not an issue at all. You know, he's still a step or two behind what we're accustomed to seeing from a speed standpoint. His shooting picked up in game four. You know, he got some rhythm down at the stretch of that game. Steve Kerr actually kept him in the latter parts of that game while it was a blowout to help him try to find a rhythm. It's going to be a while. You know, he was out 5 weeks with that injury, and you know, he can shoot. That's always going to be there. The problem is, you know, having the speed or the acceleration to get open when you're coming off those screens. And that's what he has to get back to. But I think, look, there could have been a point where the Warriors could have held Steph out for longer, you know, because that was a thought within the organization. Let's keep him out longer. But as we all know, it looked like they're on a collision course to meet up with the Rockets. So the thinking was, okay, we don't want to keep him out too long, even though he might quite not be ready. We don't want to keep him out too long. We want him to find a rhythm going into that Rockets series, because I think most people kind of believe right now that's going to be the real NBA Finals matchup.
Chris Haynes, my guest for a few more moments. All right, to that point, I don't really want to skip over Game 5 tonight and go right to that series. Yes, I do. In fact, that's exactly what I'll do. Everything, Chris, that Houston has done has been with Golden State in mind. So how do you think Golden State views the Rockets?
They viewed them as a threat, but they respect them, but they're not looking at them like that's the rival. Like they really downplayed the Rockets all season long, and I think people, you know, players in the Warriors organization found and personnel kind of found some of the narrative or the comments coming from Rockets kind of comical. You know, the GM came out earlier in the year and said, hey, we're aiming to beat the Golden State Warriors. And, you know, they tried to make a run at Iguodala in free agency. They were trying to pluck, you know, key pieces from the Warriors to try to weaken them. And, you know, the Warriors, they found it comical. That's simply put. That's how they viewed it. They really feel like when it's time to play, when it's time to get ready, that they'll put it on them. Now, I'm looking forward to that series because I really do think Houston's legit. I still will take Golden State in a seven-game series, but I'm intrigued. I remember I told you the story before. You know, during the regular season, the Rockets beat Golden State. I went up to Draymond and KD, and I said, "Hey, man, like they're gonna, you know, really give y'all problems." And you know, they essentially almost cussed me out. They're like, "Dude, don't look at what they're doing in the regular season. You know, we're not game planning for them like we would be game planning for them in the postseason." So it'll be interesting because I was told there'd be some matchup different matchups they're going to go with and potentially a different start lineup that they'll go with that they've been aiming for when they face Houston. So I'm looking forward to it.
I think we're all looking forward to that. That's one we all want to see. Now, I know you're focused on Golden State, but previously you were a Cavaliers beat writer, so you've seen LeBron up close for a long time. What do you think when you see him playing the way he is right now?
15 years in, you could arguably make the case that he's better than he's ever been. And I've never counted. Like, I was, you know, I was talking to, you know, other players around the league about Cleveland, what you think about. And they're like, oh, they're going out. Indiana's going to take care of them when Indiana was up. Toronto is going to be ready for them. Toronto was a different team. And I always held steadfast to the fact that, man, as long as LeBron is playing like this, I don't care who's on his team. I'm especially in the Eastern Conference, I'm going with LeBron. And it's proven that. And it's really disappointing, Jim. I know that this is not about LeBron, but Toronto, man, it's the same team. It's the same exact team. They build up all this hype during the regular season. We think it's a new squad. We think they've turned the corner. And then when they get LeBron, you know, they flounder once again. And I don't know what's going to have to happen, if there's going to be personnel changes, coach change, whatever. But if there was ever a year to knock off a LeBron James Cleveland Cavaliers squad, it was this year. So if Toronto can't get it done this year and get swept, man, I don't know what's in store for them, man. But it just shows you the brilliance and the dominance of LeBron James that I can't, especially in the Eastern Conference, I just can't go against him.
Chris, it's so true. It is disappointing. And I got to admit, I was one of those people who thought this year would be different. They win 59. They wrap up the number one seed. They look like a different team. They're getting it done. And then the same thing happens in the postseason. I mean, so what should they change out? Or do they change nothing at all and just hope that LeBron goes to the Western Conference?
I mean, I guess they can do that. You know, that's probably their best chance of advancing. But, you know, Jim, I knew – remember a couple years ago, I don't know if you remember this when I was covering the Cavaliers, Cleveland was up during the series with the Raptors, and Kyle Lowry was struggling. And he was struggling so bad that I couldn't believe Tyronn Lue actually divulged this information to us during the pregame presser. But Ty Lue said, yeah, you know, Kyle Lowry called me and asked me if I could help him work out, you know, work him out. During the series, Jim,
yeah, right.
During the series, the opposing team's best player is calling, and they have a relationship. They're close, Lowry and Lue. But that's still no excuse. The other team's best player is calling the head coach of the team he's going against to ask him if he can work him out.
It's like the weirdest thing ever.
Well, I've never even heard of that before. Like, and so I knew at that point, that Toronto squad, that's just a different team. That's a different makeup. Like, I don't know if they have it. Like, Jim, to really get past their demons and eventually advance to the finals, because that is unheard of. And I was kind of shocked that Tyronn Lue was divulged. Nobody knew about that.
Yeah.
Tyronn Lue came out forthcoming and gave that. And so that tells me a lot about that team. And, you know, they can't wait. They can't wait to hope that LeBron moves west. But if he doesn't, then what? What are they going to do? I think some changes need to be made.
It's Tuesday, and for many of us, that means Taco Tuesday. Stay with me now. I've got a quick question. How would you like to shop for organic groceries without paying top dollar? You can bypass those overpriced local markets and shop at Thrive Market. It's a revolutionary online marketplace on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everybody. I love Thrive Market. It's stocked with thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, and they're always at 25 to 50% below traditional retail prices. They have everything you need, whether your diet's paleo, gluten-free, vegan, kosher, and even personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, safe and non-toxic beauty products, organic baby food, kids' products, and more. In fact, much, much more. Anything you need. Click on a product and you'll see things like why you'll love it, price comparisons to retail, nutritional information, and more, including everything you need to make DIY tacos. And best of all, Thrive Market's prices are already up to 50% off, and now they're giving you an extra $60 in free groceries plus free shipping. Get $60 of free organic groceries plus free shipping and a 30-day trial. You got to move on this right now. Go to thrivemarket.com/Rome. That's thrivemarket.com/Rome. Cleveland 128, Toronto 93. And that's exactly why yesterday I called for the NBA to cancel game four, because I knew that was going to happen, because it was too brutal for everybody to watch, especially everybody involved. The Raptors may have lost that series last night, but the truth is they lost it days earlier. The truth is they lost it when they could not close out game one. And from that point on, it was only a matter of time. And that time finally ran out last night. Actually, ran out sooner than anybody expected. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that the Raptors mailed it in, that they rolled over, because they didn't. They were only down by four after the first quarter. So they didn't come out and just lie down. They fought. They battled. They just didn't have anything to fight with. They've got nothing against LeBron. They've got nothing for LeBron. This guy's like their kryptonite. They were still within four late in the first half, but LeBron had already snatched their collective soul. And somewhere along the way, they must have realized, we don't have anything here. They realized, we don't have a chance. They realized they had already been punked and humiliated by LeBron in the postseason for the third straight year. That top seed in the East, yet they were nothing more than a tomato can, a clubber for the baddest fighter in the world. This guy's 29, 11 assists, 8 rebounds, and it might have been the easiest playoff game he's ever had. He spent more than half the fourth quarter on the bench. Sometimes he'd get up to dance, but if you're in Raptors gear, LeBron dancing in the fourth when that game was already over was not nearly as insulting as him hitting this turnaround fadeaway while he was still in the game in the third.
Felt like this could be their year. And things were clicking. James. Oh, impossible angle!
Thanks to TNT. I mean, at that point, that's not even fair. At that point, that's not even right. The Raptors have families. They should not have to see that. It was as if LeBron was saying, hey, yo, fellas, in case I haven't completely shattered your spirit, ripped all your manhood and your will, how's this feel? But I'm guessing at that point the Raptors couldn't feel anything at all, which is probably a good thing. Probably a good thing because you go back over about a week's time, that same Cleveland team was dead in the water. LeBron had barely dragged them through the first round, and he was going to be on the first thing smoking out of Cleveland. And now they're the first team in the conference finals instead. The team went from absolute garbage. To a four-game sweep. And it's all because they played you, Toronto. All because they got right against you. All because they humiliated the hell out of you yet again. And the only thing worse than being swept the way the Raptors were are the questions they now face. Biggest one being, what the hell do we do now? What do we do now? Because there are no easy answers. You just had arguably your best regular season. Now strike that. You had your best regular season, but you had your worst playoff performance in the same year. You overhaul your system, you change your approach after you lost to LeBron last time, and it worked. You won 59 games. You had the best record in the East. You thought you were different. You thought this was the year. And then you lose to LeBron again. You do all that work, have a great regular season, only to get speed bagged by LeBron again. And now you're the butt of every NBA joke. Yeah, but this year is different. Will forever be linked with these Raptors, and forever is going to be a punchline. So the question, what do we do now? Do you fire your head coach? You mean that guy who was the coach of the year candidate? Maybe. But can you find somebody better? Do you try to break up Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan? Maybe. But can you find somebody better? Can you find a better combination? Or do you run it back once again with the same group and hope for different results? Maybe. But why would it be any different? So what I'm saying here is, these are all good questions, and they're all bad answers. Worst of all, maybe, do you just look at this and say, it sucks. It just really sucks. Maybe we were just the wrong team in the wrong place at the wrong time. Namely, on the same floor with LeBron in the East every postseason. Because the fact is, they've got no answers for this guy. They had nothing against this guy. They've got nobody who can work against this guy. And when the Raptors went into the tank in games 1 and 3, they had no shot whatsoever. Not even my words, but their own coach, Dwayne Casey, said as much.
Yeah, after each one of them, we were emotionally drunk, I thought, and just took the wind out of our sail.
Emotionally drunk or physically drunk or both. They let two get away, and then they get hammered in the other two. And listen, this isn't just like LeBron does this to everybody. He does it. He barely got out of the first round. The Pacers made him work for everything. The Raptors, on the other hand, didn't make this guy work for one thing. He didn't have to work for anything at all. He got to any spot he wanted. He got any shot he wanted. He got whatever the hell he wanted. So maybe you just have to live with the fact that no matter what you do, LeBron is going to be better. And that the best offseason move you can make is simply hope that LeBron goes to the Western Conference. Whatever you do, Toronto, do not watch the Eastern Conference Finals because you don't want to see any more of this guy. You've already seen enough of him to last a lifetime. And as badly as it's gone for them against Cleveland in the playoffs, this was the worst of all. It literally could not have gone any worse for the Raptors than it just did. And given who they are, that's saying something. Too bad. I like these guys. I like the Raptors. I really thought this year was going to be different. I mean, I wasn't going to guarantee they'd win, but I'll be straight. I thought they would. Seeing as to how the Cavaliers struggled the way they did in the first round, the Pacers had them beaten. Toronto was better than Indiana. They were well rested. They had the top seed. They had the home floor. They were ready. And then they weren't. And then they got punked again. So now what? Really disappointing. Dwight Freeney is my guest. Dwight, so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good. How you doing, man?
Dwight, I'm doing great. Nice to visit with you. As I mentioned, you announced your retirement last month, but it sure seemed like you could have kept on playing. So what was it that made you feel like this was the right time to walk away?
Well, you know what? I just had my fun, man. You know, I played a while. You know, I played 16 years, 16 great years. You know, I think this is a young man's game. You know, in the end, yeah, I could have played a couple more years, but, you know, I've already won a Super Bowl. You know, I've done so many other things. You know, what would I be playing for exactly? You know, and the thing is, I think the big thing that weighed in was the fact that I'm healthy right now. You know, I have my health. You know, I'm walking around feeling good. My head is on straight. So why risk that to play a few more years, you know, for what? You know, even though I still love the game and I know I can could continue to play it.
Dwight Freeney joining us. It seems to me that's the thing, right? You want to walk away with your faculties intact. You want to walk away while you feel great. And then, Dwight, you want to do something that so few athletes are able to do. You want to walk away on your own terms. It sounds like you were able to do that. How proud are you of that fact?
No, I'm beyond proud because, you know, a lot of times, like you said, you don't get the opportunity to walk away on your own terms. You know, the NFL kicks you out, or you can't, for whatever reasons why, you know, not under your control is why you are not playing anymore. So for me, you know, just to be able to do that, knowing that I could continue to play if I wanted to, makes me feel great.
We're talking to Dwight Freeney. Let me ask you about something that happened early in your career. There was a moment where you were in the locker room with Raheem Brock and Chad Bratsky, and he walked in and you said, man, he's looking old, and it took him about an hour to make it to his chair. You said to Raheem in that moment, there is no way I am seeing more than 10 years. I'm done. That's it. What do you remember about that incident and the impact it had on you?
Oh, man, it's hilarious when I look back, you know, because, you know, my last 3 or 4 years, I always get a kick, man. I walk in the locker room and I always say, man, I'm Chad right now. I am Chad. Like,
right.
These young guys are looking at me saying, man, this guy is old. And I remember playing, you know, using you in the video game in when I was 8 years old, or, you know, I get those stories, you know. So it's so funny when I talk about that story because, honestly, me and Raheem sat there like, man, this dude is ancient, man. You know, Chad's a great guy, great player and all of that, but it was just, man, there's no way we're playing this long. Look at this guy. And look at me now. You know, I'm year 16, you know, and still playing, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, not only did you become that guy, you went right beyond that guy. And it wasn't 10 years, it was 16 years. And that was after you came into the league with this rap that you were undersized. So then what's it mean to you that some people thought you were undersized, and then you go on and play not 10 years, but 16 years, and you have one of the all-time great careers, despite being, quote, undersized?
No, absolutely. And I think I use that as fuel, you know, and it's that fuel that, you know, when you have those days where you just don't feel like working out, or you feel, you know, nine reps was good enough. You know, you use those types of things to propel you in those moments where you just don't feel like doing something. And I did that so often in my career, you know, and I use it as fuel. I always said, you know, look, I'm not a basketball player. Why do I need to be 6'5"? You know, am I grabbing rebounds here, guys, or blocking shots? I get it. But, you know, for me being undersized, you know, I had natural leverage, you know, and it's about starting at point A and getting to point B. And that's pretty much what I decided to do. And I did that often. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, being undersized was actually a bad thing. I think it was actually a good thing for me.
Dwight Freeney, my guest, and I was going to say it's a game of leverage anyway. You're a Super Bowl champ. You're a 7-time Pro Bowler, a member of the 2000s All-Decade Team, and the owner of a trademark spin move that is one of the most devastating pass rush moves in history. As a result of that resume, now there's talk about you possibly going to the Hall of Fame. Is that in the back of your mind, and what's your reaction to that talk?
You know, that's something that's not under my control. You know, I gave it my all in my 16 years. You know, I've left everything out there on the field, man. So for me, I've done everything I could possibly do. And whether it be first, second, third, whatever ballot, whatever happens from there is going to happen. You know, and, you know, I don't get upset about things I can't control. I can only, you know, really get upset at things that I can control. And I know I went out there and gave it my all, man. And I left my mark in the game. You know, every time I see a guy who's undersized getting drafted so high, you know, I know, like, that didn't happen before me. You know, before me, it was a guy being drafted my height, my stature, would be a situational guy, first of all. And second of all, you know, they'll be drafted late in the third or fourth round or something like that. They were going to waste a big pick on that. And then also seeing there, looking at guys do spin moves left and right on the TV. You know, I know I definitely left my mark when I see that.
Dwight Freeney joins us. And Dwight, that spin move is something. It's iconic. And the story goes that originally it had its roots in your time as a power forward in basketball. That we know. Yeah. But when did you first start breaking that out on a football field?
Well, it was in practice one time in high school. You know, it was just kind of guys out there. You know, I think back in the day, the and-one mixtape, you know, basketball, you know, guys doing all types of different moves, you know, that was the deal back in, you know, the 90s, if I can remember correctly. And I remember being on that field like, man, you know, we should do that in football. So I remember just doing whatever it took to get to the quarterback or make a guy miss. And I think that's where it really originated from, on the football field. But it was natural for me to do it because I get called for traveling all the time in basketball.
Dwight Freeney joining us. That's great. That's awesome. Before I let you go, you've said that beating the Patriots in 06 in the playoffs ranks right up there with winning a Super Bowl. It's a really strong statement. What do you mean by that? Why do you feel so strongly about that?
Well, because of the fact that they were the mountain that we had to climb. That they were the thorn in the back or the side that we couldn't, you know, get out or just get over, you know. And it was year in and year out, we're tripping and falling over these guys. And we felt like we had the better team. We just couldn't get over beating them. And the energy in that building, you know, in Indianapolis, I've always will say that was the loudest game I've ever played as a professional. In that stadium, that particular game, the energy was out the roof. I get chills thinking about that moment, you know, the week leading up to it. You know, it was just an amazing, amazing experience. It's you know, you go into a Super Bowl week, and obviously you're going to have that energy. But I was having that same energy and that feeling in a AFC championship game and it was 1 week to prepare for this thing, you know? So you had 1 week of just pure adrenaline rush, you know, could barely sleep, get ready to, you know, go into battle with these guys. And when we beat them, you know, just the energy in the city, you know, we knew once we beat them that the Super Bowl was going to be no problem.
So, Troy, what do you
care who we were going to play. We knew the Patriots were the team to beat that year.
No, I was going to say, sorry to jump in, but, like, I don't want to be that guy who says, well, what are you going to miss the most? Because whenever somebody retires, you get that question. But when I hear you tell that story like that, I wonder, I mean, what do you miss the most? Is it the highs of the wins, the lows of the lows, the relationships, maybe the preparation that you lay out for that week? What will you miss the most?
I think a little bit of everything, but I think the most, to be honest with you, is that feeling, that adrenaline rush. It's that those goosebumps that you get. It's like, you know, I kind of try to explain this to people who, you know, when you watch, you know, that movie Gladiator, and, you know, and he sits in the middle of the arena and you hear everybody roar, the roar of the crowd. That is what you're going to miss. It's like a drug in a sense, because it's addicting, and that's why guys keep coming back, because you can't replicate that in anywhere else in your life. Forever. It's done. You know what I'm saying? You're not going to be able to, I can't, you know, there's no situation in my life where I'll have 80,000 fans cheering for me and or our team and for one thing and going at it. You know, it's something that you just have to experience to know how that feels. And I think that's the biggest thing I'll miss.
So finally, Dwight, you seem to understand that. I think you've got a really, really strong perspective about that. Generally, the guys that you know, the guys you played with and played against, how do they treat that? If you know that already and that you can never get that, do you spend the rest of your life chasing that? Do you understand you can never get that and just put it in a box over there? How do you approach the rest of your life? Because you're a young man.
Well, yeah, no, you put it in a bottle and you know, you try to put it in a bottle and then just kind of reflect on it. You know, it's kind of hard. You can't replicate that, and people try and do different things. I mean, you know, I'm very competitive, so for me, it's the golf course, right? But even the golf course can't match to it, because first of all, it's not your love, and second of all, you probably suck, right? So for me, it's kind of like, you know, I get on the golf course, I'm playing against guys that I used to play with or whatever, and great, we're playing golf, but it can't compete. You know, you hit the ball, and it's going right, all right, so I swing left, and then I swing left, it goes right, then you get mad, you play worse, So it's completely a completely different deal, man. But it's the closest thing I would say for retired guys that I know to getting that competitive juice or thing back in their life, you know. But it's just obviously completely toned down in a completely different ball game. You know?
Nashville wins last night. They beat back Winnipeg 4-0. That brings this series back for a game 7. Now I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking, that I'm going to come in here and say, I told you so. How you like me now? That was never in doubt. That PK Subban and Jim Rome were on the same page, and there was no way Nashville would lose game 6, and that my prediction still holds true. I know you think that I'm going to say that, but I'm not. And the reason I'm not is nobody likes that guy. And this take is not about me. The show is not about me. The take is not about me. This take is about Philip Forsberg. No, check that. Carl Philip Anton Forsberg. Now, I'm not just going government. I am going full-blown four-name government because he earned it last night. Why don't we start with this play to set the stage? 1-0, second period. Forsberg blocks a shot. Snaps his stick in the process, races over to the bench for a new stick, and then this happened.
The puck is shot down the side. Forsberg now with a new stick coming off the bench. Forsberg in front, he scores! Philip Forsberg, what a play! He breaks his stick, goes to the bench, picks up a replacement, comes in and scores, and the Predators take a 2-0 lead at 8:16 of the second.
Preds Radio, that is sweet. This guy gets a new stick from the bench. Not much of an angle at all. He's falling down and still buries it. Still scores. Still buries it into the net and celebrates on his back. Degree of difficulty, I'm going to say about a 9.5. That ridiculous. And yet Forsberg, because it's Forsberg, he makes it look easy. So, so easy. Anybody else scoring a goal like that on the road in an elimination game, and that's the highlight of a lifetime. But for Forsberg, that's not even the highlight of that given night. Because as nice as that was, it was nothing compared to his second goal. So let's go to the third period. Nashville up 2-0. Looking for a third to make things a little bit more comfortable. Go ahead and roll it.
Zuban at the right point. Feeds Johansson to the right half wall to the corner. Arvidsson, Johansson wheeling toward the front of the net. Puck comes back to the left point and Roman Josi. His shot deflected wide. Arvidsson tried to feed it front for Forsberg. He goes behind the back through the legs. And Forsberg gives the Predators a 3-0 lead. That was vintage Philip Forsberg.
Hey, do me a favor. Go ahead and roll that one more time because I still can't believe that I saw what I just saw.
Puck comes back to the left point and Roman Josi. His shot deflected wide. Arvidsson tried to feed it front for Forsberg. He goes behind the back through the legs. And Forsberg gives the Predators a 3-0 lead. That was vintage Philip Forsberg.
Have you seen this? Have you seen that yet? Forsberg is dirty. This guy is filthy. Between the legs in an elimination game on the road. With one sick flick. He silenced the loudest arena in that league, took all the air out of that building. But if you're surprised, you should not be. After all, this is the same guy who burned Colorado in the first round with this between-the-legs goal.
Here's Forsberg across the line, tries to stick Kendall there and got the shot. He scored! What a spectacular goal! Philip Forsberg turned it inside out. It's 4-2 Nashville.
So at that time, I thought that goal was good enough to cancel the rest of the postseason. That after seeing that, there was no reason to watch hockey for the rest of the year because nothing would top that. But I was wrong. Because if Gary Bettman had taken my suggestion, we would have missed out on both of those goals last night. I mean, I'm not sure which goal was better. Between the legs, on the move, or between the legs, standing still. But I know this. They're both incredible. And the fact that there's even a discussion is absurd. This guy has scored the goal of a lifetime at least three different times in these playoffs alone, and we're not even out of the second round yet. But don't worry, don't take my word for it. Ask Pecorine. Quote, I feel like those two series that already Forsberg has at least three or four really unbelievable goals, and it's hard to pick. I'm just a fan when I watch him play. End quote. Right, you and me both. You and me both. You'd think that his teammates and his coaches, the guys who are around him every single day, would at least be used to it, but even they're stunned. Ask PK Subban, quote, he pulls off certain moves out there that only a handful of guys can pull off in this league. It's a playoff game, and he's doing huge things like that. End of quote. It's so true. It's not just the skill necessary to pull something like that off. It's the stones that it takes to attempt it, even attempt it in the first place, on that stage, in an elimination game. Preds coach Peter Laviolette said, quote, I don't think there's any question that Phil's a big game player. The second goal was just good work by their line, but he had to finish it off. Let's be honest. None of us in this room can make that play. You've got to give him a lot of credit. End quote. None of us in this room can make that play. How many people on the planet can make that play? I'm guessing that list is short. Very, very short. Like maybe one guy. And not only how many guys can make that play, but how many guys can make that play in that situation and make it look that easy. So, Philip, the man himself, what do you have to say for yourself? Quote, to be honest with you, it is the most fun that you can have. You can never have more fun than playing these elimination games in Stanley Cup playoffs and just try to enjoy it as much as possible. End quote. So, is there a cooler cat in the game right now than this guy? He scores two of the most insane goals in an elimination game, and everybody in the building and his own dressing room are shocked, and his reaction is, yeah, it's pretty cool. It's fun, I guess. Yes, Philip, it is fun. It's a hell of a lot of fun. It's the most fun ever, and it's completely and utterly insane, but it's fun. The guy did it again. I'm watching that game last night like, damn, are you kidding me? He just did it again.
That was vintage Philip Forsberg.
And when they had to have it most. When they had to have it most. And now that thing goes back to Smashville. But no, it's not about me. And it's not about me saying, I told you so. Not about me saying, I knew this would happen.
I love when you talk hockey.
You got it. He released his debut album, Flamingo and Koval, under the stage name of Bobby Fino. We will get into all that. He is a very good friend of the program. He was on our podcast. He is now in studio live, Arian Foster. My man, it is so good to see you, Arian. How are you?
Likewise, brother. I appreciate the The plug on that's nice right there.
Dude, that ain't bad at all, right?
You got a nice studio, man.
Not bad. Appreciate you saying it. Listen, you know now, you can appreciate the aesthetic because you have your own studio.
For sure.
How's the podcast life? The
podcast is fun, man. I had no expectations going in. That's really how I live life anyway, but I have no expectations going in. That way so I don't get disappointed. But it's been a journey that I've grown from, and that was the kind of the goal on it on the onset was to kind of explore myself via conversation with other people. And it's been beautiful. I've had like epiphanies mid conversation, like really, and it's fun. It's growing. It was small, and now it's growing. We got a pretty large audience now, so it's fun, man.
Arian Foster joining me in studio. So give me one epiphany. Give me one epiphany during one conversation that you had.
I was talking to my man, and if you haven't checked him out, you need to check him out. His name's Inky Johnson. I played. You've heard of him.
Absolutely love him.
So I played college ball with him, and I got him on my podcast, and. He's like the most optimistic human being you'll ever meet, and I'm probably one of the most.
Arian, excuse me. For those who don't know, give them the backstory of Inky, because when you say he's optimistic, it's one thing to be optimistic. It's another to be optimistic with his life
right,
and what
for
happened.
Sure. So he was a college athlete just like me. We were in the same college class, and he ended up hitting a guy on an onside, and he. Injured, I couldn't tell you what he injured, but he injured something in his neck, and he ended up paralyzing his left arm. And he took that where guys would either curse the sky or curse the whatever it may be. He took that as like an opportunity to grow, and he just remained super optimistic and just the most positive human being you could ever be around. And he developed into a motivational speaker because his optimism just was infectious to everybody around. And when you listen to him speak, you'll see why. And so when I'm talking to him on my podcast, we talk about everything from the NCAA to his life, my life. And the funny thing is we've kind of reached the same conclusions in life, but in different pathways. And I found out through that conversation that I'm like in the term, I'm a pessimist because I'm an optimist.
Explain that. I like
right,
that.
Right. So I think that people in general are stupid, and people in general I don't think people are inherently good, but I want them to be, and that's why I'm so pessimistic, and that's why I'm so judgmental off rip, is because I'm actually rooting for the good in people. I just don't see it, but I'm rooting for it, and I want it. It was a dope moment for me.
So how does he see it? Does he think that people are inherently stupid or dumb or bad, or they're inherently good? How would he say that?
I don't want to misrepresent his position, but from what I got from him is I don't think he looks at it like that at all. I think he says, you're where you're at and your journey, and I respect that. And that's what it is. Like, I mean, he's a Christian man, and I'm an atheist, right? And he doesn't look at me like, you're going to hell. He looks at me like, hey, wherever you are on your journey, like, I understand that you're a good human being. He's like, we don't see eye to eye as far as theology is concerned, but like, you treat me like a brother, I treat you like a brother. You're at where you're at in your journey, and I'm at where I'm at.
He doesn't judge. He doesn't judge.
Kind of Christ-like.
Arian Foster joining us. You mentioned he's a man of faith and you're an atheist. Man, you know how social goes, right? You know how social media goes. You like to have conversations on social media. You've got a very open mind. But when you drop that on social, hey, by the way, I'm an atheist. How does that go over?
It's a mixed bag. I think secularism in the United States is kind of growing, really just in general, not just in the country, but it's growing. For the mere fact, I think there's so much information out there now where it's not just your mother or your father, or your community funneling you information. Now you can be interested in whatever you want and then go seek the information that you are interested in. So now it's not like the backlash I got from when I first came out, quote unquote, as an atheist. It's not as harsh now as it is now. And now, like, my following knows about it, and most of my following is pretty secular anyway. But you know, you get your, you know, atheist eat babies crew,
right?
And then you get your people who are like the opposite too, but like the hardline atheists assert there is no God. I'm not that atheist. I think I try to explain to people, atheism gets misrepresented a lot. It's not an assertion that there is a God. It's just a position that it's a position on the claim that there is a God, that I don't believe that position, but I'm open to it. It'd be cool if there was, but I just doubt it.
Well, that's essentially your thing too. You're open to all this. You're open to all these things. Arian Foster joining me. So we're in studio right now. If you're watching on CBS Sports Network, you can see the album cover, or if you're listening, you can imagine this. But people who know the title of the album, Flamingo and Koval, they understand that's a reference to Tupac. You and I talked about this. What was it about Tupac that resonated with you so much?
When I was little, there wasn't a lot to hope for when you're growing up in, you know, bad circumstances. They didn't have a lot of money, turmoil in the household, community just looks bad. Just, you know, you've seen it before, everybody's seen it before. But when you're growing up in those circumstances, there's not a lot to hope for. And like, and so your superheroes kind of are your athletes and your musicians. Athletes were pretty PC back then, so they kind of drew the company line when it came to anything political or any kind of things feeling. So when you're looking at a musician that can reach inside of somebody's home and say, I've been where you're at and there's hope. It was just something for me that I sat at home and cried to some of his songs before. Just when you feel like there's nothing out there for you, and he helped me cope through those times.
All right, so when he was shot and killed, how old were you? Do you remember? And what kind of an impact did that have on you, given what you just laid out?
Right, I was 12. I remember exactly where I was. I came home from football practice, actually, and my mom told me, and she was like, as an adult, I understand it now. Like, she was like, oh, son, Tupac died. It's crazy. And I was like, what? Like, my world was like, he's my only poster on the wall.
Right.
My world was, I cried. I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't even understand 100% what death was. You know, you hear about people dying, but you don't really understand at that age. And shit, I was okay.
I got you. We got you. You're all right. This is not podcast life right here, Arian. You got to know your room, my man. Know your room. You'll learn. It's all right. I'm glad you're comfortable like that.
But no, I don't. We really.
I feel like, what's going on, Rome? When you and I last spoke, you were dropping F bombs, and now it's a problem. Come on, Rome.
That's my fault, man.
It's all right, man. I got
we
you.
We lose sponsors.
I got
man.
You.
I'll cover you. But no, we don't really understand what death is now. So as a child trying to take that in, when your heroes are falling, it impacts you heavily. And so as an adult, you kind of see his flaws and where he could have been a more impactful human being, but he was such an impactful human being that he still resonates through our culture today.
All right, so I'm looking at the album cover. We're joined right now in studio by Arian Foster, and the album is called Flamingo and Koval. So if you're watching on CBS Sports Network, you see this. If you're listening, you can either look this up or imagine it. I'm looking at the cover, and it's really, really aesthetically pleasing. It's interesting. There are two hearts. Right. One looks pretty happy, almost frolicking about. The other looks depressed. I could venture a guess as to what that means, I can ask you exactly what it means.
Shoot, because artist interpretation is everything. That's what art is. You interpret it how you feel. So go ahead and shoot.
Yeah, I think that partly it depends where your frame of reference is and where you're coming from. I'm seeing a heart on your shoulder, and he looks pretty happy, or she, or whoever it is, frolicking about, pretty happy. You know, a certain lightness, and the other one is definitely depressed. He's got his hands on his knees. He's got a certain heaviness, the weight of the world on his shoulders. And then I see behind you something, a totally different topic, the galaxy. And I know you're about physics now.
Right.
So this is kind of what I'm seeing.
Right. So, yeah.
How did I do?
You did pretty well, man.
Thank you.
So the thought behind it was the heart that's sitting in the chest is where it's, quote-unquote, supposed to be. And the heart that's on the shoulder is where it's not supposed to be. And where you are supposed to be, you're kind of... you kind of distraught, you're depressed, and the one you got that right, and the one that's frolicking, great word, is kind of just happy and freely being about, and it's kind of a metaphor for the entire moniker of Bobby Fino is where what you're doing, whatever you're doing to keep the lights on, where you're supposed to be, usually is something that doesn't fulfill you as a human being, and you're not very happy doing it. But where you're not supposed to be is where you're most free. And I wasn't supposed to be making music. I'm not supposed to be making music, but it's where I look up at 3 a.m. and I have an 8. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. And it's really all I do in my life now is try to inspire people via conversation, via art. It's just trying to get people to go back to that person that you once thought you were, that you weren't once thought you were going to be. It's because it's just not like, so I know we go to work, we got to pay the bills, but like, you have to step outside of the matrix sometimes and just really look and be like, this is not what life is. Like, it's not about keeping the lights on. It's about enjoying it.
Aaron, there's a lot to unpack there, but this is why you come in here. Let me ask you this then. If you do what you have to do to keep the lights on, and we all do, and in a lot of cases that's not what you should be doing or what you want to be doing, was football to keep the lights on so you could ultimately get to this, and is that not what you necessarily want to be doing?
I mean, as a 31-year-old man, I say, yeah, I understood that I had a talent in playing football, and I fell in love with the sport. Don't get me wrong, but it was something that I felt like I had to do. I always felt like I had to play football. I had to take care of my family. I had to make sure my family was good. I had to make sure my kids were taken care of. And it was never something that I mean, when I was a kid, I think I fantasized about being the greatest running back ever. I just wanted to be the best ever. And then as an adult, you kind of realize, or I did anyways, I realized that a lot of the greatest of all time conversations it's just barbershop talk. So legacy is just what people think about you in a barbershop. I don't care about what people think about me in a barbershop. And that epiphany hit me like midway through my career. Like, I really don't care what these people think about me, because they're going to think, well, yeah, you could be whoever you want to be. Mother Teresa, you could be Gandhi, and somebody's going to be like, he's a piece of crap. Like, it doesn't matter what these people think about you. So I'm literally breaking my bones to appease other people. Like, I can't do this for much longer. And I knew that I still love the game, but at the end of the day, I knew that it wasn't something that kept me up at night.
Did you love the game, or did you love what it could do for you?
I love the game. Okay. I truly love the game. I did. There was times where I hated it. I got up, went to meetings, and I was on my way to practice. Like, I hate this. I cannot stand this. And then I'll get an outside zone carry. And when I had the ball in my hands, it felt so freeing. And that's what I fell in love with as a kid, because it took me away from the problems and the L's that I was going on, that was going on in my life at the time. And it took me back to that time where I just felt free and I could just escape. So I did love the game, but it didn't fulfill me as a human. I didn't feel like I was adding anything to society.
Aaron Foster joining me in studio. All right, so one of the tracks on the album, A Friend, A Fan, A Kid, right, it's from the perspective of how a friend of yours, a fan of yours, and a kid of yours all view you. Right. So as an athlete, how did you view the relationships in your life?
Right. So, I mean, it's very... the reason why I made that track was because I think I needed a segue, because I think a lot of musical careers that transition from athletes are awful. I'm going to be honest. They're not good. And I think they're not good, not because... art is subjective in general, but I think the reason why the quality isn't there is because people don't give it the thought and the time that artists do. It's their livelihood. And I think you have an off season and you just get in the studio, but like, you don't really put in the thought behind what message are you really trying to convey? What are you trying to give to the masses? And that track is a beautiful segue, in my opinion, from an athlete to a musician. if you look at it, with an open mind. Because it is a really detailed account of how I felt people in as the relationships in my life viewed me. Like, you get that, like a friend of mine, you get that, oh, well, why ain't you talking to me anymore? Oh, you think you're Hollywood now? And then a fan is, oh, you're a dumb athlete, just shut up and play. And then as a kid, it's like, I mean, I love my kids to death, but it's hard to be that dad that's making you peanut butter jelly sandwiches every single day when you got to go out and provide it to a certain level where you never have to worry about where your meal's coming from. Some things that I had to worry about as a kid. So it's balancing all those relationships. That's why you see a lot of abuse in narcotics. You see a lot of abuse with other people in entertainment. It's because those stresses from entertainers weigh heavy on people. And they don't know how to deal with it because they're the breadwinners. They don't have nowhere to go. And so I was lucky enough to, you know, have this avenue where I could express these things. And I always did. And by no means did I walk a perfect life. I had a lot of bumps in the road, man. But I think this stuff kind of helped me keep sane.
Aaron Foster, my guest, his album is coming out right now. In fact, it's already out. You know, before I let you go, one last thought. What do you make, as somebody who's not afraid to exchange thoughts, opinions, share your thoughts, what do you make of the difference between how the NBA and the NFL responds to players speaking out on social injustices? Right. This is something important to you, but there's a definite distinction between these two leagues. What do you make of that?
I think it's indicative of how ownership and league offices view their players. So in the NBA, I think they view their players. I mean, they understand that their players are the product in the NFL. They don't. I don't think they look at them like that. I think they just kind of look at them like cattle and they'll be replaced. Whereas, I mean, it's true. Don't get me wrong, but it's true in the NBA as well. But I think the NBA understands that the brand of their league is the face, is the faces of these players. And so they keep a good relationship and they say we're partners rather than employer relationship. And I think that that proactive relationship builds character. Amongst everybody. Like if you look at some of the rules or some of the things that the NBA does, they say go be active in social injustice.
They encourage it.
And the NBA, NFL, they shun it. They do shun it, and they tie social activism to anti-Americanism, anti-police, anti-everything, which is the opposite of what is the truth. But I mean, these kind of conversations are important, whether the NFL or the NBA is active or encouraging it or not, because we're all products of the society and we live in the society. So I think you have a responsibility to partake in these conversations and understand the nuances that have everybody up in arms or not. But it's important to have these conversations.
Have the conversation. Yeah. Have an open dialogue. Have the conversation. This debut album is out right now. It's Flamingo and Koval, released under the stage name of Bobby Fino. Arian, so it would seem pretty self-evident and obvious, but not everybody knows how to get something like this. If they want to get the album, how do they go about getting it?
Right, it's on all streaming platforms, so whether you use Tidal, whether you use Spotify, iTunes, Apple Music, Pandora, whatever you use, it's on there. Just type in Bobby Fino, and it'll pop up, and I appreciate every ear, man. I think if you give it an honest listen within the first track, you'll understand that it's different than any athlete album that you put out. And honestly, it's different than any album that you're going to hear right now, because I care about it, and I use musicians of the highest quality. Like, we do this.
I was going to say, one last thought. You and I talked about this on the podcast. Was that not a concern that people are going to come in with preconceived notions? How good could it be? It's an athlete. I know this guy. I see this guy a certain way. You're trying to get them to come in with a blank slate, right? An open mind. Just listen to it and forget who did it.
Right. It's not necessarily I'm looking for them to come up with an open mind, because that's hard. That's hard to do. You have to be a very balanced person, sure, to come up with an open mind. So just listen to it, because I feel like once you hear it, you'll see a distinct difference between, not like I said, not necessarily just athlete albums. I don't think it's a question. It's the best product an athlete has ever put out. That's not even a question, in my opinion. And I'm a humble human, but it's just obvious to me. but when you look at some of the music, it's on par with some of the music today. And the beauty of it is these songs are like 3 or 4 years old. I've been working on this for a while. So like the stuff I'm working on now, I'm gonna continue putting out great music, and it's quality. So if you have some time, man, it could be a soundtrack to your life, man.
Flamingo and Koval, Arian Foster, under the stage name of Bobby Fino. My man, so good to get caught up. Really nice to see you here in studio. I think it's a great piece of art. Really nice to have you. Thanks so much.
Appreciate you, boss.
Appreciate you.
Good night.